Welcome to Hollywood in Color, where I tell the stories of the stars usually left out of entertainment history. The people of color in front of and behind the camera who have been representing for over a century. I'm your host, Diana Martinez. On the evening of August 11th, 2017, the same night that white supremacists marched through the University of Virginia campus in Charlottesville, Virginia, carrying torches and chanting Nazi slogans, the Orpheum Theater in Memphis, Tennessee, was having a screening of the 1939 film Gone with the Wind, part of the theater's 30-year tradition of celebrating film history. The next day, neo-Nazis held a rally in Charlottesville to unite the right, in part protesting the impending removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee, and in part demonstrating their strength in political legitimacy and impunity under the Trump administration. Anti-racist and anti-fascist demonstrators also attended the rally. 19 of them were injured, and one woman, Heather Heyer, was killed by a white nationalist. Shortly after these events, the Orpheum Theater received complaints about their screening of Gone with the Wind, a film that romanticizes the Confederacy and all it stood for. By late August, the theater decided it could no longer, in good conscience, play the film.
The backlash over shameful eras of American history has spread into movie theaters. Gone with the Wind is being pulled from a series of classic movies in Memphis, Tennessee for its portrayal of slavery. Now, this movie won 10 Oscars, including the first one for a black woman, Hattie McDaniel. Now, should it be pulled? It's a great movie. It's a depiction of a time and an era, and it's a piece of art.
Absolutely not.
No.
It's not exactly accurate, but it is one woman's and Margaret Mitchell's vision. It's a novel, for God's sakes. It's a fictionalized sort of dramatization.
It captures the time. It's someone's expression of what they experienced or a story to tell. You can't rewrite those
the
things.
The slaves are the only nice people in the movie, if you think about it.
Well,
the rest of them are so mean, every one of them.
I think I could see both sides of the argument. I mean, you know, as a lawyer, I know that that's classic censorship. You know, you're going to take books out of schools and movies out of movie theaters. But I do wonder, how is that different from all the Confederate flags that are being taken?
The discussion that you just heard among the hosts of the daytime talk show The View distills a crucial conversation about the power of images, of art in shaping our ideologies. Is a theater choosing to play Gone with the Wind or not a symbolic way of condoning or rejecting racism? Or even more simply, is the film itself, a film taking place in the pro-slavery Civil War South, racist? Or is it just historically accurate? Are those two things mutually exclusive? David O. Selznick, the producer of Gone with the Wind, understood the power of film, and he knew adapting Margaret Mitchell's best-selling novel could cause concern, controversy, and outrage. He knew that there were parts of Mitchell's novel, particularly her depiction of the Ku Klux Klan, that could be seen as, in his words, an unintentional advertisement for intolerant societies in these fascist-ridden times. Selznick was Jewish, and he was deeply affected by the anti-Semitic propaganda that helped Adolf Hitler rise to power in Germany in 1933. As a Hollywood insider, Selznick was also keenly aware of how Hitler had used film, in particular, to galvanize Germany. And he knew how the Nazis continued to shape German ideology by exerting unprecedented influence over the content of Hollywood films being imported into Germany. So when Selznick was working on the script for Gone with the Wind with writer Sidney Howard, he stressed over the overtly racist things, going back and forth about whether to include the book's normalization of the KKK or debating whether to include the use of the N-word. But Selznick never seemed to think about whether the entire endeavor, the romanticization of the antebellum South in Technicolor, was itself an advertisement for intolerance. And so, he was taken off guard when Black moviegoers, movie critics, and activists protested the film before a single frame had been shot. But what really got to critics wasn't the film itself, though they did have objections about that. But they were more flabbergasted by the willing participation from Black actors to be in Gone with the Wind. They expected the white guy to make a racist film, but how could actors want to play slaves? Why would they want to relive and make believe about this very real oppression? Hattie McDaniel was at the center of this controversy. By 1936, she had become well known for playing maids. She was always the sassy domestic help, entertaining but stereotypical. So when Selznick began casting Gone with the Wind, she really wanted the part. She saw it as expanding her repertoire. She was a maid, but with depth. But she couldn't foresee, or maybe she just didn't care, about the size of the backlash. This is episode 2 of Hattie McDaniel, Showstopper. I beg, urge, coax, and plead with you to read this at once. I know that after you read the book, you will drop everything and buy it. That's what Katherine Brown, also known as Kay, told her boss, David O. Selznick, when she read the 1,037-page advanced copy of Gone with the Wind. The book was being published by Macmillan, and it was the first novel of a former Atlanta journalist, someone who was on no one's radar. Margaret Mitchell didn't even have an agent, so Annie Laurie Williams, who worked for Macmillan, took it upon herself to make the book as successful as possible, and that meant securing a movie deal. Annie made sure the galley, the unpublished proof, got around the movie industry. People at Warner Brothers and MGM read it. Katharine Hepburn, who was at the studio RKO, read it. The book was getting a lot of buzz, but the studios were hesitant. They didn't want to make more costume dramas. Those weren't doing so well at the box office, and they didn't want to make more Civil War films because those had tanked too. But Kay convinced Selznick, who had his own independent production company. So in 1936, a month after publication, he signed the biggest deal for a novel up to that point. He bought the film rights for Gone with the Wind for $50,000, almost $905,000 today. Within a month of publication, Gone with the Wind had sold 176,000 copies. In 2 months, 300,000. By 6 months, it had sold over 1 million copies. A 1,000-page book that cost the equivalent of $54 today sold 1 million copies in 1936. The next year, Margaret Mitchell won the Pulitzer Prize and the second ever National Book Award. Now, this context is really important, not because I want you to admire the book or anything, but because so many canonical books and films, those that are valued as important, become big deals in their afterlife, decades, generations later. But Gone with the Wind was quickly a book that people became invested in, and fans were psyched for the film adaptation. To make it more clear, it was like the hype around the adaptation of 50 Shades of Grey, or maybe more like Harry Potter. I mean, Gone with the Wind was a literary Star Wars. Fans wrote to Selznick begging him to cast their favorite male star as the dashing Rhett Butler. Actresses called him begging to play the fiery Scarlett O'Hara. there hadn't been quite this much excitement for a film since, well, The Birth of a Nation. Okay, of course people were excited about movies since that infamous film premiered in 1915, but many readers noticed echoes of Thomas Dixon's novel The Klansman in Gone with the Wind. Director D.W. Griffith adapted The Klansman, changed the name, and made The Birth of a Nation, which was, for its time, also an incredibly ambitious and problematic project. Mitchell's novel was undoubtedly shaped by Thomas Dixon's literary version of Reconstruction. Actually, she wrote to Dixon, telling him, "I was practically raised on your books and love them very much." After Gone with the Wind came out, Dixon wrote to Mitchell saying that not only had she written the greatest story of the South ever put down on paper, she had given the world the great American novel. Both Dixon and Mitchell's stories harness the same nostalgia for the antebellum South that was incredibly powerful for white readers. In these books, whiteness is threatened by economic and cultural forces that are embodied by blackness, black people. In Birth of a Nation, Klansmen literally gallop to the rescue of an angelic white maiden from the clutches of her black attacker. And in Gone with the Wind, this scene is all but replicated when two black men attempt to rob Scarlett. Ashley Wilkes, the upstanding man of Scarlett's affection, is a Klan member and, along with others, avenges Scarlett's attack. He assaults the camp of free black men. D.W. Griffith's film adaptation of Dixon's novel made a resonant story even more powerful. After the film, there was a resurgence of the KKK, and they adopted, for the first time, the symbol of the burning cross, an image that appeared in Dixon's novel, but didn't become an icon of hatred until Griffith's film. Racist violence increased in the years after the film's release. This isn't just a tenuous connection, there's a direct correlation. The film spoke to white men and women who wanted to hear their resentments and fears and prejudices voiced out loud, and it invited them to act on those emotions. African Americans didn't forget The Birth of a Nation and everything that happened after that, and Gone with the Wind read similarly. The buzz was familiar. The readers looked the same. The book was published during a time of heightened Klan activity following the end of World War I. And so, when some film fans, writers, and community leaders heard about Selznick's plans to adapt Gone with the Wind, they were, rightfully, alarmed. Though there was opposition to Selznick's adaptation from leftist organizations, the NAACP became the spokesgroup for voicing concern. Walter White, the head of the NAACP, was passionate about changing black representation in Hollywood. Walter personally wrote to David O. Selznick, arguing that the book is so essentially superficial and false in its emphases that it will require almost incredible effort to make a film from the novel, which would not be both hurtful and inaccurate. He urged the director to hire a consultant who could make sure that the film was racially sensitive and historically accurate. He suggested hiring Charles H. Wesley, who was dean of Howard University. Selznick replied, "I hasten to assure you that as a member of a race that is suffering very keenly from persecution these days, I am most sensitive to the feelings of minority peoples." But really, he thought he didn't need any more consulting and hassle. He thought he had done enough. He had taken out the N-word completely. He had gotten rid of any mention of the KKK. And he was burning through his budget fast. He had hired two consultants already, a white historian and a white speech consultant. But the biggest reason for his hesitance was quite simple. Selznick thought a cultural consultant might lead to even more modifications in an already ever-changing script. He was concerned that such a man would probably want to remove what comedy we have built around the black characters, however lovable the characters may be. He was probably right. Many didn't see Mitchell's characters as lovable and cute. Earl J. Morris, the film editor for the Pittsburgh Courier, wrote, "Negro actors and actresses should vie for roles that will permit them to display dramatic ability and run the gamut of emotions instead of consistently seeking to portray grinning flunkies and cotton pickers." Casting for Gone with the Wind was incredibly difficult. With so much fan investment, Selznick had enormous pressure to get it right. He knew he needed Clark Gable to play Rhett Butler, but he couldn't figure out how to make it happen. Leslie Howard, who wanted to play Ashley Wilkes, didn't look young and debonair enough, and Olivia de Havilland was stuck in a contract that would be very difficult to get her out of for her to play Melanie. Selznick wanted someone great to play Scarlett, an unknown maybe, but the casting calls were going terribly, and none of the major actresses who auditioned were really perfect. And as for Mammy, her chemistry with Scarlett would have to be amazing, which was hard since they didn't know who was playing Scarlett. And the woman who played Mammy had to conform to the spirit of Margaret Mitchell's character. There were auditions after auditions for about a year. Hattie McDaniel auditioned, Hattie Noel, an actress, comedian, auditioned. Eleanor Roosevelt herself recommended her own cook, Elizabeth McDuffie, for the role. Selznick wanted to see a test with Louise Beavers, a star who was coming off the resounding success of the film The Imitation of Life, where, though she played a maid, was one of the main protagonists, essentially a co-star to Claudette Colbert. Louise's casting hit a snag. The story goes that Louise was called in for an interview. Being the star that she was, she showed up in amazing clothes and an amazing coat. But Hattie McDaniel showed up to her interview dressed as a mammy. And Selznick loved that. He claimed he could smell the magnolias with her in the room. For a producer, Selznick lacked imagination and was consciously or not put off by Louise Beavers dressed in fine clothes. Dressed in clothes that accurately reflected her Hollywood status, but didn't reflect the version of blackness Selznick wanted to put on screen. Ultimately, the role of Mammy came down to two women, Hattie McDaniel and Hattie Noel. In screen tests, they were paired up with four actresses up for the role of Scarlett. Hattie Noel auditioned with Joan Bennett and Paulette Goddard, who was Selznick's favorite, and Hattie McDaniel auditioned with Jean Arthur and Vivian Leigh, a striking British actress whom Selznick really didn't want to hire. After those screen tests, Selznick decided Hattie would play Mammy. But not everyone was convinced. Susan Myrick, a reporter and the dialect coach on set, wrote to Margaret Mitchell shortly before filming got underway. "Hattie McDaniel is not the right Mammy," she said. "Hattie lacks dignity, age, nobility, and she hasn't the right face for it." But Selznick was convinced that Hattie was a good investment. All actors of the time were treated somewhat like commodities to be traded, sold, or leveraged as bargaining chips. Selznick signed Hattie to a renewable 15-week contract beginning February 1, 1939. She would earn $450 a week, a little over $8,000 a week today. This was a lot of money. This is a lot of money, even by today's standards. But Hattie's white co-stars were making anywhere from 5 to 10 times her salary, in addition to bonuses and stipends. And this Hollywood hierarchy was based on seniority, race, and gender. Vivian Leigh, for example, made about a third of Clark Gable's salary, even though, as the protagonist, she was in practically every scene of the film. The inequity on set didn't stop at salaries. In a May 2006 interview with Turner Classic Movies, Lenny Blewett, an actor cast as an extra in Gone with the Wind, recalled his experience on the first day of filming.
When we got to the set, I noticed all the outdoor porta potties, and I couldn't believe my eyes because each potty had a sign above the door that said white, colored, white, colored, white, colored, all the way down. I told the older guys, my God, on private property? Culver City, California? You gotta be joking.
Though segregationist Jim Crow laws were enforced in Los Angeles, formally, informally, and inconsistently, the black cast members found an ally in Clark Gable.
So I went up to Clark Gable, who was the Brad Pitt of that day, you know, the Tom Cruise of that day. I knocked on his door. I heard Gable say, let him in. And he didn't know Lenny Blewett from Adam, you know. He said, yeah, well, what can I help you with? I said, Mr. Gable, I've got a problem, a very, very big problem for me and my men. And when I said me and my men, then he knew that I was serious, you know. He said, what's the problem? And I said, would you give me just 2 seconds of your time? And I took him out to where the venues were, and I showed him those signs. And he looked at those signs and read it, and then it dawned on him. And he got on the phone, one of those portable phones, they rolled up to him, you know. He called Victor Fleming, the director. Get me Vic! And he called the property master. And I don't know who else he called, but he cussed like a sailor. And he said, if you don't get those GD signs down, you don't have a Rhett Butler in this film.
This story didn't make the press in 1939. But even if it had, like today, many critics, writers, and activists felt that the world of Hollywood was so far removed from the real world that any injustices within it were just the problems of rich, privileged people. Writer Earl Morris uses Hattie's salary, which he cites as less than it actually was, to point out how divorced she was from real struggle. We feel proud over the fact that Hattie McDaniel won the coveted role of Mammy. It means about $2,000 for Miss McDaniel in individual advancement, and nothing in racial advancement. Hattie had heard this criticism before, but during the filming of Gone with the Wind, she never addressed these accusations. There are stories that she played a major role in convincing Selznick to excise all utterance of the N-word from the script, that she tweaked and played with Mammy's lines to create a more believable character. But there are also stories that tell of her singing and dancing for the cast and crew, baking cookies for them, giving Susan Myrick homeopathic remedies for her cold to get on her good side. Look, Hattie was awesome and nice and generally a joyful person, but these stories, which appeared in fan magazines at the time and are now retold in different biographies and books about the making of the film, use these anecdotes to prove that Hattie was Mammy. And Hattie was surely aware that those comparisons would be made. Maybe she even purposefully weaponized the stereotypes the white cast and crew had of her to make friends, to maintain her career, to survive. But we don't really know. Hattie, along with her co-stars Butterfly McQueen, who played Prissy, and Oscar Polk, who played Pork, were used by Selznick and the studio as tokens. They sent them to do interviews confirming that Gone with the Wind was not prejudiced or insensitive and that it was historically accurate. That was a key point that Selznick and the studio relied on in order to dismiss concerns about the subject matter. Oscar Polk was even made to write a defense of Gone with the Wind that was distributed to the newspaper The Chicago Defender. He wrote, "The characters that appear in the picture, Pork, Mammy, Prissy, Uncle Peter, Big Sam, and Jeems, are all true to life. All of them could have, and in fact, actually have, lived." And though she never mentioned it, it must have been a blow when Hattie, after all that work and the criticism she withstood for the film, wasn't allowed to attend the premiere in Atlanta. In fact, her picture wasn't even allowed to appear in the program due to the city's strict Jim Crow laws. Selznick wasn't happy about this. He saw a missed marketing opportunity for the Black cast to make special appearances in the community. But he was also disappointed because in the final cut, he had seen Hattie's performance, and it was sensational. He wrote to his publicist telling him Hattie delivered a performance that, if merit alone rules, would entitle her practically co-starring. He told another colleague, "I think she is going to be hailed as the great Negro performer of the decade." Audiences thought Hattie's performance was remarkable. When her name was mentioned in a speech after the screening, the crowd cheered. The next day, Margaret Mitchell wrote to Hattie, "I wish you could have heard the applause." There is one particular scene that shows Hattie's range and dynamic performance style. In the film, Scarlett and Rhett have married and had a child who dies in an accident. The couple's already fragile relationship disintegrates and Rhett is crushed from losing his child and from losing the woman he loves. Mammy calls on family friend Melanie Wilkes, played by Olivia de Havilland, to help Rhett.
Miss Melly, I sure is glad you've come.
Oh, Mammy, this house won't seem the same without Bonnie. How's Miss Scarlett bearing up?
Miss Melly, this year has done broke her heart. But I didn't fetch you here on Miss Scarlett's account. What that child got to stand, the good Lord give us strength to stand. It's Mr. Red I was worried about. He done lost his mind these last couple of days.
Oh, no, Mammy, no.
I ain't never seen no man, black or white, sit at the store on any child. When Dr. Meade say her neck broke, Mr. Red grabbed his gun and run out there and shoot that poor pony. And for a minute, I think he go out to shoot himself.
Oh, poor Captain Buck.
And yes, and Miss Scarlett, she called him a murderer for teaching that child to jump. She said, "You give me my baby what you kill." And then he say, "Miss Scarlett ain't never cared nothing about Miss Buckley." It like to turn my blood cold, the things they say to one another.
Stop, Mammy, don't tell me anymore.
And then that night, Mr. Red, he locked himself in the nursery with Miss Barley. But he wouldn't even open the door when Miss Scarlett beat on it and hollered to him. And that's where he's been for 2 whole days.
Oh, Mammy.
And then this evening, Miss Scarlett, she shouted to the door, and she said, "The funeral's set for tomorrow morning." And he says, "You try that, and I killed you tomorrow. Do you think I'm going to put my child in the dark when she's so scared of it?"
Oh, Mammy, he has lost his mind.
Yes, and that's the God's truth. He ain't going to let us bear that child. You got to help us, Miss Melly.
Oh, but I can't. True.
If you can't help us, who can? Mr. Red always set great store by your opinion. Please, Miss Melly.
I'll do what I can, Mammy.
After the film's release, criticism was still divided, but more fans and critics agreed that Hattie's portrayal of Mammy was as human and humane as the story allowed. Perhaps encouraged by this response, Hattie became bolder in her public statements. She stated that she had based Mammy on brave women abolitionists like Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth. Hattie claimed playing Mammy was her chance to glorify Negro womanhood. Hattie began looking for support for an Academy Award nomination. There were rumors, maybe started by Selznick or Hattie herself, that she was in the running. And as much as Hattie probably wanted to win for herself, Hattie knew that her nomination would be significant, a sign of progress. And as much as Selznick believed that Hattie deserved to be nominated, he was also probably thinking that Hattie's nomination would quiet his critics. Gone with the Wind was nominated for 13 Academy Awards. Hattie and Olivia de Havilland were both nominated for Academy Awards for Best Supporting Actress. The 12th annual Academy Awards were held at the Los Angeles Ambassador Hotel inside the Coconut Grove, a nightclub. Hattie's agent, William Michael John, had arranged for her to be allowed into the all-whites club, but she had to sit at a separate table away from her castmates. But this didn't stop it from being her big night. She wore an aqua evening gown with gardenias running along her shoulder. As she was getting ready, she probably already knew that she had won. The Los Angeles Times had leaked the winners in the late edition of the newspaper. And if she didn't know then, she probably knew when she walked into the ballroom and the crowd broke out into applause. She was making history. She was the first. The first African American nominated for an Academy Award. And the first to win.
That I present the Academy Award for the best performance of an actress in supporting roles during 1939 to Hattie McDaniel.
Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science, fellow members of the motion picture industry and honored guests. This is one of the happiest moments of my life, and I want to thank each one of you who had a part in selecting me for one of the awards. For your kindness, it has made me feel very, very humble, and I shall always hold it as a beacon for anything that I may be able to do in the future. I sincerely hope I shall always be a credit to my race and to the motion picture industry. My heart is too full to tell you just how I feel, and may I say thank you.
In the next and final episode of the season, Hattie faces more criticism and more obstacles, all the while continuing to be a pioneer of entertainment, this time conquering radio and television. This episode of Hollywood in Color has been produced, edited, and narrated by me, Diana Martinez. All artwork for the show was designed by Shelby Mooring. Every episode of this podcast is heavily researched. If you want info on the books, articles, and sources I used, check out the show notes. There, you'll also find info about the theme song and other music used in this episode. If you liked this episode, please leave a rating for the show wherever you listen to this podcast. If you have a little more time, a review would be awesome. Let me know what you like, what needs improvement, and of course, your ideas for future seasons. And with that said, I can't wait to tell you another chapter of our story next week.